Eric notes has certain people under his thumb, and he's persuaded them to put this question.
He's a dentist, that's why.
Yes. Drill is for boys with coffee. You know what that word means, don't you? This is the triad above the personality, which Eric, through his slaves, has a question to expand the relation of these three. The interesting thing about this analysis, the Hindu analysis, is that the top word, for those who can't see, we'll bring our deaf and dumb expert to spell out with finger gestures ATMA. Donald? Can you make those gestures?
I can't
do Braille in public. ATMA. Now let's look at it and see what it does, because in this peculiar language, the Sanskrit, there is a definite intent by priests of the ancient world to define by means of letter symbols philosophical concepts that shall be absolutely consistent within their symbology. So it is not the kind of symbology you get out of a Christian Science manual, where the argument is not very tight, or out of Unity Church, where the argument is even looser. This is a symbology in which every letter has a meaning, and compiling letters together gives you a concept which can be analysed by breaking down the letters and showing logically and consistently that there is a definite relation between ontological facts, facts of being in the universe, and a symbology to represent them. You know that when babies are first born and you smack them, they say, ah. And the reason they say that is because they haven't yet been told to articulate. They haven't been made to practice prunes and prisms and rains in Spain and rugged rocks and rugged rascals and things like that. So they just say, ah, when you hit them. Until they're replying in filthy Esperanto. So, in this particular symbology, the letter A symbolizes the absolute, and the letter T symbolizes any intersection of forces within the absolute, and the word At means father or generative power, and the verb to eat is derived from it. So the same word, absolute crucifixion, absolute intersection of forces, or the intersection of forces within the absolute, implies the edibility of the universe to its creator. The second part of the word, ma, implies, in the M, a closure of your lips, a substantial power, substantial because circumscribed. Because circumscribed, offering a resistance. Because offering you a resistance, giving rise to this concept of substance. So that the activity of the absolute, preceded by the glyph for M, ma, means substantial activity absolute. This is ma, this is appetite. So we have the edible and the appetite. The same word is used for the self of a human being. Atmat means yourself. When we consider this word, therefore, we must say that the essential principle of appetite and edibility in a man is exactly the same as that in the absolute. There is an equation: the highest self of man is the absolute, operative absolutely in the place of that man. So that every man is an absolute self-determinant being, but he is twofold. He's not only the father of his own activities, art, he's also the edible to any other art mum who might be about. Every being is a power, the intersections of which constitute its own formal structure, and every being constitutes fodder for every other being. It's quite obvious that in using Atma in this sense, that they've already begun with a profound metaphysical truth, that every eater is edible, and had better watch out for every edible eater. The whole problem of human ethics is who shall eat whom, when, where, and at what price. So, when we take the Sanskrit term, and remember that in an ordinary lexicon, you would find it means self, and it could mean just self, higher self, and so on. But here in this triad, it means the absolute power which in its self-crucifixion, self-intersection of its own forces, generates substance, and that this substance activated constitutes this being's own appetite. Every being is eating up every being. The absolute is eating the absolute. Every individual being is trying to eat up the absolute, and not doing too badly considering its small size. When we think about that speck and dust of the earth, and one little speck and dust there with an idea travels 250,000 miles through space to put another speck and dust on the moon. Considering the small size of man, his intelligence is absolutely fabulous. Because that little tiny bit of matter on earth, however the astronomers, the Hoyles and so on, pretend that because it's a little bit of dust is nothing, the intelligence that produced that dust and organized it and gave it mobility and mentation and lifted it up to the level where it can actually survey itself, that intelligence embodied in that dust is the cause of the dignity of the dust. And it is ridiculous to take a spatial concept of bigger bodies are better than smaller bodies, if in fact a relatively small body, that of a human being, has the intelligence inherent within it to battle with the cosmos effectively to a tremendous range, because going to the moon is only the beginning of a lot of other journeys, not only on the physical plane, but on every other plane of being that there is. The intelligence in man is the intelligence of the absolute, and therefore man is inherently a dignified being, a noble being, when he knows what he is able, a no-able being. So when we see this word Atma, we must mean the self as such. The Atma is the self. This self is a being that is an eater and is in sheer danger of being eaten. There are big fish and there are little fish. The big fish are eating the little fish. Some of the little fish are so small that the big fish don't even know that they've eaten them. And they've set up a house inside the big fish. And they're busy selling the inside of the fish to outside fish. So the self is one with the absolute, and therefore there is an equation. Brahman comes from a root meaning to be extended. So that the absolute as extended infinitely is Brahman. But the same absolute as appetite, self-determinant absolutely, is called Atma. And therefore there is an equation. Atma is Brahman. This self in man is the extended consciousness, power of the absolute. In every man there is a point of reflection, of self-awareness. And at the point of self-awareness, it is the absolute being self-aware in the place of that man's body. And it is this absolute self-awareness in a man that gives him an absolute right to resist any other absolute man making absolute statements. This is the ground of the self-determination which will ultimately be the foundation of a government of self-conscious beings, undupable by each other, and therefore forced by the logic of the situation to cooperate. Now the next level to be considered is the buddhi, and this implies that there is a circumscription and there is an analytical process within this circumscription, and out of this analysis comes this power. You know that when you split atoms you can make big bangs. You can also make big bangs by driving things together. You can make a bang when you separate things and another bang when you put them together. This has to do with the fact that all things ultimately are energy, and this self, by an analytical process inside itself, of itself, by itself, has illuminated itself as to its own potentialities. It, this self, this being, by self-observation within, has discovered that when it analyzes in itself and breaks an idea, it illuminates itself by showing itself another form of possibility or way of doing something which prior to the analysis it did not have. E equals mc squared made the nuclear bomb. To be able to see why it did required a lot of analysis over many thousands of years, and the retention of that analysis in the protoplasm of the human race until it culminated in a certain person who suddenly nodded his head at all ancestral efforts and said, "That equation means power." This was a Buddhic process. It arose through playing the violin, actually. Because, of course, music puts you above the level of the lower mind, because it involves you in a rhythmical process rooted in cosmos itself. So this buddhi means pure logic, not empirical logic. It is pure logic, the logic we call logo logic, the logos logic. Logos is the name of the ratio principle running through the whole cosmos, not derived from external stimulus but derived from internal self-knowledge. So there is a self, and here is an analytical process within the self which has illuminated the self about its own potentialities. This self, by self-illumination, discovers that it is a being who can say Bu, who is Sanskrit for space, let there be space. And he can divide this space, and out of this division he can produce power. And with this power he can apply to a point, to a particular situation, and the power derived from his analytical process of his own being will dominate the situation into which he puts it. Now, the Manas here is an evolute of the buddhi. That means to say that your counting process, substantial motion issue, when your substance moves you are evaluating. So that means say that every being that is living or mobile in so far as there is an emergent, an issue of the motion of that substance, is manas. And that word is the origin of the word that we say mind. Mind, mentation, mentality, mensuration, all the same word, MN. This manas is the mind counting process which will apply itself to the external world. Now before it applies itself to the external world, here, it is simply that the self, by self-analysis, has counted its own parts and the issues thereof. Because if we take a being and put a wall in it, like we would in an amoeba before dividing it, You can then allow that energy from one side goes into the other side, and from that side into the other. We can allow osmosis, endosmosis, any osmosis. This process of two-way flow, of two-way issue, you must be Jewish, of two-way flow is itself already manas before there is an external world. And therefore, this manas itself is already a very high process, because it means you squirt from one part of your own being into another part of your own being a certain characterized energy such that it balances your being in a very peculiar way and patterns you. Now that manas function in the human being and in animals controls in the human being what we call the endocrine system. It controls all those glands in your body which are busy squirting stuff into the blood, and through this squirting they are influencing other glands in other parts of the body and making them, say, squirt back. So that the whole body is a system of squirts from cell group to cell group, and by means of this intercommunication of squirts the being is vitalized and equilibrated in a very peculiar manner such that it becomes aware reflexively that it is a self-stimulating being eating itself. So that by the time it comes down to the monastic level, it is able to stimulate itself deliberately and consciously. It could say, oh, well, I think I'll make a bit of adrenaline now, and then I'll shout at that old lady. It can do this quite deliberately. It can determine its own chemistry. And it can be nice and horrible by squirting the appropriate substances, because every chemical substance is a precipitate of a type of will. Chemistry in the body is nothing but precipitated intent of a will to do something. So now when we have this higher trial, we see that if this self-squirting were to go on, is it safe to call this, David? Alone inside that being would never undergo what we call the form. Because it would be a self-stimulating system. It would know what it was doing to itself all the time. But within the infinite, this kind of process of circulating energy can go on anywhere at all. So that within the infinite, this can happen. I'll pay you. And when we get two such circulating entities, both of them Atma Buddhi Manas, we have a new situation, the situation of contingent relation, relation of touch, where the peripheries of two beings touch. Now, before this second being existed, in the state God lived alone, one without a second, everything was all right because he was his own boss, and there was no problem. But the moment a second one appeared, the possibility of peripheral stimulation occurred, and then A, the Absolute, found that another thing, a B, was squirting into its zone without prior consultation. The amusing thing is that there cannot be any prior consultation, because you have to knock to persuade the other fellow to discuss with you whether there should be a prior consultation. So the mere fact of the pluralization of entities means that there is interference before you have time to see whether anybody wants to be interfered with. A lot of young men don't understand this, so they wait to interfere with the lady for permission. And waiting for permission means no universe. Those who know this, they just knock and say, oh, so you may be refused. At least I have not. This process of two-way squirt of two discrete entities is the cause of all we mean by trouble. problem, disease, and so on. If there were only one being, there would be perfect ease, because it would give orders to its own substance in the way that it willed to do it. But because within infinite possibility, within the field of sentience, any number of finite systems can be set up, contingent relation can appear, two-way squirt sets up without prior consultation, and the result is that A may react to B in a way that B didn't expect, and B may then reply to A's reply in a way that A doesn't expect. And this is what we call human communication, misnamed. So here we see that the manas, because we say Atma in the center, buddhi around it, and manas here, the manas is the external of this higher triad. When it comes into contingent, that is tet relation, with another being, Atma, buddhi, manas, the two manasic levels, remember these are not gross materials, they're very, very fine, but they are circumscribed, and therefore technically they come within the realm of substance. These two beings at the mental level or manasic level, they squirt mental energies into each other, and they either like or dislike it. There's no prior consultation. And when they squirt in this manner, some of the things they squirt are noxious. Those of you who have seen a beautiful caterpillar, very gaudy coloured on a leaf, and picked it up to examine it, will understand that you can be squirted on in a highly noxious manner. And when you are squirted on in such a way, the tendency, you put a bit of it in your mouth, you'll find it, is for you to shrink. Now imagine a manas is a very fine thing in itself, because it is the self counting its own squirts backwards and forwards within its own terms. But when it comes to another manasic being here, an idea that is a form of energy, very fine, is squirted from one to the other. And if this idea is unassimilable to the other being, that is to say, not in accordance with the will of the other being, because that's all that unassimilable means, it means I don't want it. If it is unassimilable, this being shrinks away from the stimulus. As soon as it shrinks, its own manasic level is compressed and determined by the contingent stimulus. So that instead of manas, now, being a self-examination of an internal self-stimulation, it is an empirical stimulation and response to an empirical situation. The external now has coloured manas. The mind now has an external thing to which it will adjust or refuse to adjust. So the moment contingent stimulation comes into existence, then manas shrinks, the mind withdraws. You can get rheumatism like this if you withdraw hard enough, long enough, to unpleasant mental suggestions. You can get all sorts of funny things. In fact, all diseases are caused by shrinkage from some order of unpleasant stimulus. So when this manas shrinks back from the contingent situation, it has actually been conditioned by an external stimulus, and therefore we can't really use the same term. We have to add another word to it to symbolize that this manas is no longer the self-stimulating, self-knowing mind, but is the contingent mind determined by an external stimulus. So, very clever these people, they say, having written Atma Buddhi Manas, imagine us here above there, and we put manas here again, the same evaluator, but we prefix it with another word. There is a glyph like that, meaning a force is hitting onto something, and that force hitting in that manner turned round is the letter K. K means to knock and to keep. It implies there is a closure, and it says when the closure activity conditions your appetite. That's kama. You are kama mas. That is, your evaluation is now determined by the external stimulus hitting on your periphery. And the moment you focus on this, you lose your awareness that you are a self-stimulating being, and you react to the conditioning stimulus. Now, loosely, this is translated by certain people, lower mind, without going into the psychology and metaphysics behind it. But it means, quite simply, the kama manas is that mentation process which is conditioned by your appetite being stimulated from outside you. Kama is Sanskrit for the god of love, or the cupid. Cupidity has the same root, because the capere, cupere, kipere, and so on, all imply that you have been captured by the stimulus. To be cupid is stupid. It's quite legitimate. It's not just a joke. It's quite legitimate metaphysical change of the prefix. To be captured, to be posited and divided by the stimulus is cupidity, stupidity. It's a technical term, not a moral statement. He who stands in pid is standing on his pedal extremity, and because it has been touched or stimulated, he is reacting. So this lower mind is the mind that's conditioned by an external stimulus affecting your appetite. You notice that atma has now become tama. That is, the absolute self-intersecting, self-stimulating being is now a locked up being. This is an activity within a closed situation, and because closed, conditioned, and because conditioned, relatively blind, and therefore kama manas is the empirical mind determined by appetite, by want, by like, dislike, desire, aversion, wishing and wanting, hating, all those things which arise from an external stimulus come underneath that word. So we have above this line a manas which is self-stimulating, and below it a manas or mind conditioned by an external stimulus. Now it is this going under the dominion of the external stimulus and nothing else in all major religions that is signified by the myth of the fall. There is no fall other than from the level of self-conscious reflexive self-stimulation into subordination to the external stimulus. This means you can have immediate salvation by just not responding to external stimulation. It's in the school of Zen. Just give it up. Don't evaluate the external world as worthy of your attention, but decide that you are a center of creative values. You insert value into the world instead of expecting the world to insert value into you. If you abandon your appetite for closed situations, that's called privacy, you change the quality of the manas here back to its unconditioned phase. Now it's obviously here where the battle of the human being is concerned, because above that manas is that buddhi. To remove the conditioning factors of the external stimulus is to allow the original manas or self-stimulator to function and to put you back in your spiritual triumph. But there is no other way possible for any being to return to spirituality other than by this conquering of the slavery to the external stimulus. Now every being has to climb. Minerals can't suddenly see this, they're too busy. The elements themselves at the mineral level, the electrons going round the protons and neutrons in the nucleus, do not respond immediately to a suggestion that they're being merely mineral and start efflorescing and becoming trees. They're obstinate. Obstinate means quite simply they stand in orbits. And if you charm, which is possible to do with atoms, with the appropriate words and emotions and so on, if you charm atoms, minerals, electrons jump orbits. And when they jump orbits, certain changes occur in the body, which are called miracles, like drilling holes in your hand, like Jesus and things like that. Any kind of stigmatist phenomenon comes under the heading of induced changes caused by the becoming aware that you are a self-determinant being at some level. Chemical changes in the body are precipitated by act of will. And the will of the Absolute is towards the creation of reflexively self-conscious beings. To do it, the Absolute had to will primary particles to serve as centers of reference for an infinity of reflexive beings. So his first job from the Absolute was to posit a point. We write A for the Absolute, and we write a dot for the letter I. But the dot on the I is really the letter itself. The Absolute's first word is I. The Absolute posits a point. That's I. That's affirmation. What it is affirming there is a negation. Because the first point laid is a mineral. It is rotating on a centre in order to be a point. Now the Absolute posits within the Absolute like this. It posits a lot of such primary particles because they are logically necessary to serve as centres of reference for sentience. Without the precipitation of primary particles, there could be no centres of reference. So the first thing the Absolute has to do is abandon in the zone to where he posits his free absoluteness and posit particular bondage. Now this is a dreadful thing to do, for which the Absolute has to pay a very, very sore price later, when he has himself to incarnate in order to resurrect. The consciousness of the Absolute, being entirely logological, sees the logical necessity of primary particles, and it makes a lot of them. Now these primary particles are the matter that science says is conserved, or the masses of energy that are conserved, and they will continue to be conserved, or if some of them are destroyed by clever men, they will immediately be remade for the same purposes. They are there to serve as reference point and to make a mosaic and to pattern them in various ways, to group them together and out of primary particles to make atoms, out of these molecules, out of these various compounds, proteins, plants, animals, men, and the ultimately reflexive beings called divine humans. But the primary particles have to remain in existence and be affirmed by the Absolute until the consummation of days. The word day means a division affirmation. And when the ultimate target is fulfilled, that is, there is perfect reflexive awareness of the beings defined, then the function of the primary particles will cease and they will disappear, and there will only be the Atma Bhuti Manas level again in full reflection. But the mineral world will remain until that is done. So when this Absolute posits its primary point like that, then it can send energy to rotate around that point, and it can demark the cosmos in this way. It can subdivide this cosmos in various ways. It can spin this sphere and make an equator. And we've written here R-E-O-A. Push the whole thing through space. We've now written a row of vowels. Five vowels signifying five levels of being within the creative process of the Absolute. And each one of them has a definite function. Each one of them is strictly necessary for the evolutionary intent of cosmos to produce reflexively conscious beings. So when we examine this Atma Bhuti Manas, we have to say that the Atma is the absolute self, and that same absolute, when it has posited the point and referred to it, is now an individuated self. It is still Atma, but it is Atma individuated. And that dot on the I signifies individuation. And the moment there is individuation, there is a possibility of an evaluation of the individual order that prior to the appearance of the particle, in the absolute, did not exist. And the pluralization of consciousnesses by the absolute makes an infinity of absolutes, and thus the absolute shows profit on itself. Because prior to pluralization, the absolute has not got another one to compare with. So it is as if it were not. But by pluralization of the absolute, it makes souls, psychic entities, spiritually aware, so that it can play with itself absolutely, which is the supreme joy of all the great religions. The deliberate, conscious, creative, imaginative exercise of a plurality of reflexive beings. So there we are, that we have this personality structure, physical body, and the three above it, the empirical mind, conditioned by desire, and if you remove the desire conditionings determined by the external stimulus, the mind refines itself. Now you can see the ground of all ascetic practices of the past in this, because where you control your desire, the energy that would have gone out of you towards the object of desire does something inside you that it can't do if you let it out. In other words, it differentiates you instead of the situation. Now, nobody can sacrifice for nothing. So if you say to a person who doesn't understand that principle, control yourself, you give him orders from outside. If he responds to your external order, he is kama manasik. He is desire conditioned, and he can't get the benefit of it. On the other hand, if he hears the truth and does not respond to it, he can't get the benefit of it. So he has to do a very peculiar thing. When a truth is presented to him, his first duty is to make a quick mental note that it is truth, and his second duty is to see that he doesn't bounce into external awareness because of it. So you see, here, Atma, Bhuti, Manas, a higher spiritual triad in which the absolute, knowing itself to be what it is, an absolute appetite, also the absolute meal that it has to eat, by subdivision within itself, buddhity, it makes itself into a cosmos of pluralized beings, and these it squirts one into the other absolutely, and so creates reciprocal relations within itself. But because of the logical possibility of pluralization producing contingent relation, there is a real danger that individuated beings within that cosmic sphere will fall into slavery to the external stimulus. And the moment they do so, that is the fall. And the moment they fall, they have a long, long way to go to get back. The fall is an involutionary process, and the way back is an evolutionary process. How's that different with the triad now? See, Eric Nance's.
Eugene, could you say a little bit more about someone who is capable of dealing with their bodies to the extent that they feel horrible and they can sort their adrenaline and gas out? Because I can't see anyone who's got themselves. Can deal with themselves to that extent. Do you ever think that somebody is horrible? And therefore, I can't imagine. Is this the choice that makes an individual?
Well, you see, this has to do with the law of sacrifice. When we take that terrible word up, Mark, the absolute cannot get rid of itself. And therefore, it has to say to itself, I am an appetite. The power in me is intersecting and stimulating me. And I must do something or nothing. And if I do nothing with it, I am absolutely irritated with myself for non-development of my potentialities. I can inhibit my creativity at the price of being internally absolutely furious with myself for inhibiting my creativity. But it's either or. Because I'm not nothing. As the absolute, I'm essentially a creative power. I can't get rid of this fact. So if I don't create, I'm simply inhibiting my creativity, and that is energy inhibited. And as I'm an appetite, I don't like being inhibited. So I have to say, oh gosh, I will create. Blow what happens. Because it's so unbearable not to, I'll do it. And whatever happens, I will apologize for it if it's horrible. Now, as a result of my creative process, there arises within the infinite an infinity of beings, one of whom is a little old lady, with certain habits that I have to define as horrible. Now, she might be a very nice old lady to some people, but I will have need at some point to define that little old lady as horrible.
So you will deliberately.
This is the idea of sacrifice. I mean, Jesus was quite a nice bloke, but Caiaphas had to define him as horrible. Because the total situation says that somebody is not noticing how nice that old lady is. The whole purpose of my reflexive intent requires some horrible old lady. She's a nice old lady, but she can be made horrible if I give her the right stimulus. Because she's Kamamanasi. And I will forgive her for the horribleness imposed upon her. And that horribleness will make everybody reevaluate little old ladies. Spurgeon got a little old lady that's the essence of sweetness and kindness and shone light on everybody. Whenever she went shopping, people opened the door for her and men behind counters jumped to serve her. And she only did nice things. Wouldn't really everybody want to live with that little old lady? Wouldn't they really? Wouldn't it produce a kind of idolatry of that little old lady? Now, to stop this idolatry, we have to trip her up somehow. This is a fact of human nature. There is somebody who's terribly nice, everybody wants to live with them. So it becomes, at some point, a duty to become horrible. This is part of dialectic. In the logological sense, the highest mercy is the greatest severity. Because you know what happens when people try to avoid being severe? They inhibit themselves and then they blow up. Because the elementary fact is that if you inhibit yourself, you've not destroyed the energy that you inhibit. And because that energy is sentient power, it is appetite, and it will get its own back on someone, somewhere. There's no escape out of this dilemma. Is there, Barbara?
Did you say there was no escape?
Yes. Because there's no escape. How do you interpret no escape? There's a different kind of escape. Fire escapes? No escapes?
No.
No, it simply means negation. The continuity of a process of circumscription. Now that's a very good escape. All you have to do is negate the negation. The negation is the external stimulus that some cunning being, maybe the absolute or one of his emissaries, gives you to knock you into reflection. He says no to you, and that is your escape. You can't move otherwise. If you found a beautiful person like Krishnamurti, terribly handsome, Krishnamurti, the Messiah, he was a boy that was adopted because he was beautiful by a man and a woman who had certain ambitions, and they defined him as a Messiah, and they prepared the world to receive him, and they spent $2 million on advertising, and they put him on the stage, and then he said, terribly sorry, I'm not, and ran away and went to California and wrote poetry for a living. Now, his only trouble was he was very handsome, and he's been worrying about it ever since and writing books. Thou shalt not have a boss. That's all he writes about. There are no authorities. That's all he writes. Why? Because somebody tried to make him into one. He wanted to do something else. And they adopted him and said, no, you are not a normal child. You are a potential Messiah. Those two people knew that everybody was, but not everybody is handsome. So they thought, well, he's a potential and he's handsome, and a handsome potential is better than an ugly one, so we'll use this one. They didn't allow for Atma Buddhi Manas in him developing itself to the point that it could realize that all the good books they gave it to read, like the Bhagavad Gita and the Tao Te Ching and so on, that they were true, and that he actually realized their truths before he fell into saying he was what he was, that everybody else is, if they knew it.